720 WGN, a very happy Friday afternoon, everyone. It's 12:09. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Hansen, in for John Williams for this hour. Pete Zimmerman across the glass, he produces this hour of the show. And often we check in with Mr. Mike Miller about all things that are happening across the country. He's the Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Michael, thanks for hopping on with us.
It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, the first story that caught my eye, and you too, comes from the St. Louis Fed. A lot of people wondering about states that took away those unemployment benefits or ended them quicker than some of the other states. And we finally have some data that indicates what?
Well, it's interesting that we only have limited data, but we do have data before the decision and then after. And what we were finding, which was consistent with the unemployment claims that came out yesterday, all groups, all states were declining together. But as soon as the states decided they were going to remove that extra federal money, the two diverged. The states that kept the federal money, their unemployment claims continued to decline, but much more slowly than the claims that existed in the states that removed the money, which is a roundabout way of saying that as soon as the money was not there to stay home, which would have been income greater than you could earn in a job, people decided pretty much to go back to work or to try to find work more diligently than they were before.
I'm lucky, Mike. Yeah, I have a graph in front of me, so it's really easy for me to understand it. But let's just make sure we note that all the states, the blue and the red ones, have continued to see some decline. It's just ones that withheld the money federally have seen a steeper decline, yes?
That's right. Yeah, the decline, I believe that the numbers on the graph are 7% for the states that kept the federal money, 12%. Now, I know that's not a lot of percentage points, but that's a considerable difference. You know, it's almost twice as fast. But it is consistent with what economists would expect. You know, we economists always talk about costs, benefits, and incentives. And if someone gives you an incentive not to look, if they provide you the money necessary to stay home, then you won't look because work is hard. You know, mm-hmm. Leisure is better. So when the benefits that you would get of staying home are reduced, you will then take more actions to try to do something about it. So it is something we would expect to see. So I'm not at all surprised at the results. The only thing is we have to see how large a number of people we're talking about. This is not the entire labor force. This is just those people on the margins who were having trouble getting jobs.
Yeah, for sure. We'll keep an eye on that, obviously, and see if they end up evening out once the federal employment benefits end in mid-September, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right.
All right. This is interesting. I did not know, and I'm so glad you explained it to me, what the beige book is, the Fed's beige book. Can you tell people what that is and what we learned on Wednesday?
Yeah, the beige book, it's one of my favorites. And it has a funny name, the fact that it's called a beige book. In the old days, before digital, all the people who made the decisions on monetary policy would receive several books, and they had different colors covers on them. And the one that had a beige cover was called the beige book. And what happens is in all the 12 districts of the Federal Reserve, they have a team that goes and makes phone calls and visits businesses around the entire district. And they promise that they will not divulge who they're talking to. So these contacts will be very truthful about how their businesses are doing and what conditions are like. So the beige book is a qualitative analysis of the condition of the economy, not quantitative. There are very few numbers in it. It's all that we hear a contact telling us that they have trouble getting credit, or they can't find workers, or the number of people coming into our business is rising. So these are qualitative indicators. You know, so much of in economics and macro, much of what is important are things which are not quantifiable. They're not, we can't make numbers that will clarify what's going on. And this beige book is important because the Federal Open Market Committee that determines monetary policy, they use this along with the numbers to make the decision on whether or not to change interest rates or their forward guidance and so forth. So it is an important report to the Fed, and it is a report that you and I could never get any other way. We can always look up the numbers for the GDP and the inflation and so forth. But to actually have the ability to contact people in your district and say, how are things going really? and have them tell you exactly how things are going. I think that's a very important indicator in the economy.
Yeah, and I imagine, Mike, it's a matter of reading both books, the beige one and the more, or all the books, whatever it is, because, yeah, the numbers will tell you the numbers, but to get the pulse, I guess, that's kind of what this beige book looks at.
That's what that's all about, you know, because the numbers are, you know, they, of course, well, numbers are all backward looking, and these interviews are done very quickly, and so this is very recent data, which I think that they know. And then what the FOMC does is they combine this qualitative data with an analysis of forecasts of where they think the economy is going in relation to their what they call their dual mandate. They have to control inflation and create conditions for maximum employment. And the Beige Book is one of the important indicators. And it's free, by the way. You just go to the Board of Governors website, and you can read it for the country as a whole, and then there's one for each of the 7 or the 12 districts of the Federal Reserve.
We'll dig in a little bit more about what it's saying about Chicago in a moment, although I will say I wonder if the person who first put a beige cover on the books wishes they had picked something a little bit more bright and exciting.
Yeah,
than just
I know what
forever
you mean.
Known as
it
the
is.
Beige Book.
Yeah, we've kept the name the whole time. They never changed it after they went digital.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Hansen filling in for John Williams. Mike Miller joins us on the line. We were chatting about the Beige Book, which is kind of the pulse, the anecdotal stories that are happening from businesses about what's going on in the economy, as opposed to the qualitative. Wait, now I messed them up. Quantitative, excuse me, the numbers that also go along with it. I don't think I asked you, Michael. Okay, so what are we seeing here for Chicago out of the Beige Book?
They're very careful in what words they use. So the word they're using for the Chicago area is moderate. The economy is moderately growing. If it were speeding up, they would tell us. If things were slowing, they would use those kinds of words. So in a sense, what we're seeing in what they call the 7th district, which would be all of Illinois, the Chicago area, it's about the same as the country as a whole. We're all making progress towards getting back to the pre-pandemic economy. The labor market is fine, and of course, everybody across the country, they're having trouble getting workers to come in. Either there's a problem of the number of workers available, or there's a mismatch between the skills that are needed and the skills that the people have. So what we see countrywide is happening also in the Chicago region.
So if it were a beige book of emojis, it would just be a slight smile face, I guess you could
That's
say.
That's right. Yeah. I like that. I think we should recommend that to them, that they put an emoji at the title of each section.
Reading monetary policy, it could use some emojis. That would help me understand
That's right.
it a little bit
oh,
better.
Oh, my gosh.
There you go. I am really interested about another topic you sent along about income disparity between black and white families. There's kind of two parts to this discussion. Let's talk about the what effect monetary policy can have in terms of risk management and stuff for different types of families and what you're seeing.
Yeah, see, for the longest time, the Federal Reserve did not pay any attention to the effects across different groups of people. And I'm not sure that they can even develop a policy that would be specifically geared towards a group of people.
Right.
But we have known for decades that the policy can affect people depending upon where they invest their money. So, for example, when the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates as low as they have, which is essentially zero, for those, maybe you and me and so forth, who want to borrow some money, this is wonderful because we can get money so cheaply. But what if your grandma and you have a limited amount of money in the bank and you've got to make sure that that money is there for your retirement?
Don't want to take risks.
You invested in the bank and so forth. The problem becomes that you earn no money. And if you put your money into government treasuries, you earn no money. So monetary policy can affect the returns that people get depending upon where you invest your money.
Yeah.
So that was the first part of the study. The second part was, is there a distinction between the way that black families versus white families invest money? And we've known for a long time, the way to become wealthy is to take risks. So if you put your money into very safe instruments, you're not going to become wealthy. You're going to have money, and you're not going to lose anything, but you're not going to become wealthy. So they tried to figure out, is there a difference in the profiles of the investments of black families and white families? And they found the answer is pretty much yes. There are two things. One, blacks have many fewer dollars to invest. But secondly, when it comes to where is the money invested, on average, white families seem to take bigger risks. They put money into stocks and maybe real estate and so forth. And black families take fewer risks. But of course, as you know, there is a risk-return connection.
Of course.
And the more risk you take, the bigger the returns. So over time, over a 5 to 10 year period, those who take these larger risks will have their money grow much faster than those who take very few to no risks. And so what we're seeing between the races is that there is a different profile in terms of where people put their money, and it has consequences over long periods of time in terms of how much wealth black families have versus white families.
Right. And of course, part of that discussion is generational wealth and passing money on down and having a head start and other things. And I think that even if the Fed can't make policy on these sorts of things, maybe some education procedures will certainly help people to make sure that they can get as much out of their money as possible. All right. I also want to talk about the disparity when it comes to what you call, or what this article called, monetary policy shocks. Can you explain what that is and then how that affects disparity?
Oh man, I'm trying to remember that part of the study.
Sorry.
I know a monetary policy. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say I didn't mean to put you on the spot here, my friend.
Oh, that's okay. It's just a monetary policy shock would be, like when the Federal Reserve would make a decision that is unexpected. Now we do know that when if you have a policy from the Fed, which everybody knows is coming, its effect upon the economy immediately in terms of like the stock market and people's decisions to buy and sell and so forth will be quite muted because they've already built that into their expectations. But if you have a surprise by the Fed, like tomorrow or Monday, if the Fed had a phone call among its members and decided they're going to raise interest rates, you know, one full percentage point, that would be a shock in the economy and the stock market and everything would go nuts. So when you have a random shock like that, it will have different kinds of an effect. And, of course, depending upon your risk profile, mm-hmm. That, you know, if you have everything in, say, in stocks and the Fed does something that out of surprise that could change the value of stocks, maybe drive them down dramatically, then, of course, you're going to take a major hit compared to somebody who has their money in very safe instruments.
Let's talk about U.S. retail sales. Unexpectedly, you see a rise, 0.6% in June. It's not having too much an effect on the market here today, as Steve mentioned, kind of balancing that with the rising inflation. What's your take on this retail sales up?
Yeah, the retail sales number, it was in line with expectations. Okay. Now, the reason I'm not one a big, I don't think that expectations number is important unless you're investing on it explicitly. But markets do, in fact, invest upon the information of what they think is coming. So they want to be positioned before the number actually comes out. The retail number was pretty much in line. And why this number matters is that consumers like you and me are more than two-thirds of the entire economy. And retail sales deals only with things, physical goods. It doesn't include services. So we're talking about essentially one-third of the entire economy is kind of measured by this retail sales number. And the number was good. People have again opened up their wallets and purses and begun to spend. We're seeing apparel's doing well, appliances and electronics. Now, the one area that's having trouble, you might be able to guess because of a chip problem, is automobiles. Mm-hmm. There just are not as many automobiles available for sale. Their prices are going up very quickly. And so the traffic in the dealerships has relatively speaking, declined. And that's kind of muting the retail sales number. And one of the problems, of course, is that chip problem. Now, I'm not a chip expert or an electronics expert, but my understanding is that this could be with us for 6 months or more before the sufficient number of chips are available for cars to be built in large enough numbers that people can buy whatever car they want at whatever time they want. So the one, in a sense, downside of the retail number was that weakness in the auto sector.
Let's talk about inflation here before we let you go. Obviously, sure. Inflation continues to rise, and that's obviously putting pressure on the markets. I think a lot of people buy into the idea of what the Fed is saying, that this is transitory inflation, this will ease up. I think a lot of people nod in their heads in agreement, but make different decisions when it comes to investing. But we haven't seen any huge downturn. Is there like a line in the sand for you or other economists where we know that this is a bigger problem? Is there a number in mind? Is there a month where we continue to see rise? Or is it not quite as line in the sand as I'm describing it?
No, there is no such. I wish there were some particular, what we would call a monocausal, a single cause that we could point to and say, well, this will be the thing that will tell us that inflation is going to be temporary or permanent. I think the Fed is correct that so much of this is based upon some pent-up demand, some unique situations like autos where you have a problem with the chips. You also have people, again, beginning to travel and so forth. And prices are rising, but they're still not even back to where they were before before the pandemic when it comes to airfares and hotels. So, but see, the CPI picks up the change. It picks up the rise. Mm-hmm. A very respected economist at the Northern Trust, Carl Tannenbaum, I took a look at his forecast to see what he's telling his clients. And he sees a decline in inflation by the end of the year. So a lot of people I'm trying to figure out, are they seeing the same thing that I am, that mm-hmm. this is a temporary phenomenon? And I think the answer is yes, that many of us do. And we will be surprised. You know, I will never say never when it comes to the economy. But I would put a majority of my money on the idea that inflation will begin to subside by the end of the year.
All right. Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Thanks for hopping on with us today.
Hey, it was great to be with you.
Have a great weekend. All right, let's jump in with Dale Buss. He's a frequent guest here, veteran financial journalist. He's the founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition, flyovercoalition.org, where you find more about them. Dale, thanks for hopping on with us today.
Absolutely. Great to talk with you, John.
Yeah, you cover a lot of things that are happening in the Midwest. And we're going to open up this discussion about Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford Motor in a moment. But I have a very general question for you when you think about CEOs. I set this up before the news about, you know, there's a discussion in like baseball. How much difference does a manager really make, right? It's the players that make most of the difference. A good manager versus an average manager maybe gets you an extra win a year. What's your take on CEOs and their importance in the general overall health of a company, like an average one versus a great one? I mean, can they make, it seems stupid to ask, but how much difference can they make with such a big company underneath them?
Well, I think the analogy to sports and superstar athletes is not a good one, actually,
okay.
Look at the NBA, look at the finals going on right now, Milwaukee, Phoenix. I mean, how much difference do the coaches really make versus, you know, Giannis or Booker? Whereas with a company and a CEO, they can make, they are more than mere caretakers and managers. And if that's what they are, then they're not going to last very long or the company's going to have a hard time. They're hired for their leadership. And you look at the difference that visionary CEOs have made. I mean, go back to the era of Steve Jobs and what he did with Apple. I mean, I know he was a co-founder, but then he became the CEO and he's like, this is a whole different enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Elon Musk with Tesla. Do you think he doesn't make any difference to, the assembled bench of Tesla and SpaceX? So not every CEO is that visionary or has that big an impact. But I think that CEOs, more than just functionaries or managers, the good ones, the ones that have impact, and there are many of them, really can make a huge, you know, fundamental, even transformative difference in leading companies. And that's why I think there's such general interest in CEOs and even kind of a celebrity cast to them for many people, in addition to, you know, the fact that they run these companies and help make the economy go.
That's interesting. Let's go and jump in right to the article you wrote about Jim Farley quickly acquiring traction. I really like the pun, intended or not, as the CEO of Ford Motor. Tell
easy
us about
to make
what...
automotive puns, right?
Yeah.
I write for Chief Executive Magazine a lot and talk to a lot of CEOs, and I just was finding interesting some of the really neat things that CEOs lately have been doing who happen to be in flyover country, happen to be in the upper Midwest here in your listening area, because it's such a test these days for CEOs and what they're going to do with their companies in a post-pandemic world. You know, what's the new normal? How do you adapt to it? You go back to the office, do you not go back? How do you deal with all these things? And so Jim Farley is an example of one of those kinds of CEOs who I think has the potential to be transformative, because really for the last several years, since a guy named Alan Mulally turned Ford around during the last recession, the company has been kind of bumping along and really arguably falling behind other global automakers. And Farley, who's been in the Ford system for a while, he was the chief marketing officer. He comes along, he's the new selection as CEO, and he has already made a huge difference. He's committed the company to electric vehicles and to making their own batteries, as they hadn't been even arguably 6 or 9 months ago. He's recasting the company to Wall Street and other people as a technology growth company, not as a traditional automaker. You know, even things he's dealing with now with the microchip shortage and having to cut production for Ford and just sort of jockeying everything around there, he's made some tough calls. So, you know, I think he's an example of, as you were sort of introducing this segment, of a CEO who is more than just a manager. He is making a transformative difference there. It'll be interesting to see going forward. Obviously, a hugely competitive business. You need a CEO who can make a difference. You need an Iacocca or a GM. Mary Barra has made a huge difference for that company. So it'll be a really interesting story to follow, you know, going on.
Yeah, it's a great article. You go to chiefexecutive.net to find it. Some eye-popping numbers, spending more than $30 billion by 2025, which isn't all that far away on electric vehicles, expected to account for 40% of global sales by 2030. And when you hear the name Ford, that's just not the first thing you think of.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah. And he needed to do something to up the ante for Ford in the EV derby, because General Motors under Mary Barra had certainly done that, and Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, everybody else is doing it. Who knows what, if all this money will be spent and if EVs really will take over the market. But, you know, he clearly recognized, okay, we have to do more at Ford to be part of this revolution, however far it goes.
Yeah, you don't want to be left behind. Let's talk about Northwestern Mutual. No. They want most people back in the office. There is this battle that plays out on, at least on social media, on Twitter, which is never a great place to get a pulse of what's actually happening in the world.
Yeah,
but there is a definite push by a lot of people saying, no chance. I might go back once or twice a week, maybe a hybrid thing, and you have these businesses coming out with news saying, no, we want people back. This is going to be a real tussle, I feel like, with workers. But again, that might be just playing out on Twitter. You might actually not see it quite in real life. What's your take on this back to work shift?
Well, I think it's easy on social media for everybody to sit in their pajamas and say, I don't want to go back into the office. And so it's a huge struggle for CEOs to figure out, you know, what is essential activity in the office, out of the office? Can these activities be conducted virtually? You know, what needs to happen back in the office? And the thing is that so many companies that spent so many years before COVID building up cultures at work, in the office, in the plant, you know, making these places communities and great places to work. And then you just want to dump all that and allow people to just communicate virtually. For a lot of companies, that's not going to work. And so you see a lot of CEOs saying, oh, we're going to try and keep everybody home. But John Schlifske, who's been in charge of Northwestern Mutual there in Milwaukee for about 11 years, I think, he's made two tough decisions. One is he said, look, I want people back in the office. We just spent, you know, $450 million to build a 32-story new tower here on the landscape of Milwaukee. We equipped this to be a great place for people to work. You know, we don't put the executive offices in the cushy spots. We let the collaborative workspaces take up all the spots with the great views. They did so many things in this building to make it great for the 2,400 people who work there. It's like, I want people back there.
Yeah.
And they're going to try their darndest to get everybody back there that they can by fall, you know, with some flexibility, which they've always had for people. He thinks it's really important to keep the company's competitive edge and their culture. But on the other hand, he also made the decision that Northwestern Mutual's customers are going to be able to basically maintain virtual relationships with their financial advisors, because they found that's what people want. If you've got a financial advisor come into your home, you got to, you know, fix them a piece of toast, you know, sweep the driveway, whatever, you got to keep an appointment. And they found that customers really would rather have these relationships mostly virtually. So yeah. He's made two radically different decisions on how to conduct their business going forward. That takes vision, you know, that takes some guts to do that. And, you know, another example of a CEO from our region here stepping up to some really important decisions.
Yeah. Dale, we're out of time, unfortunately. You also wrote this great article about business-to-business manufacturers helping people out when seemingly you don't really need to. It's morally you expect consumer-facing companies to be the ones giving back. Go to chiefexecutive.net for that article. It's a really great read. Dale, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Nice talking to you.
You too.
Bye.
And you can go to the Flyover Coalition, flyovercoalition.org, for more information about what Dale does there too. All right, let's get a look at the Wintrust Business Minute with Steve Krasanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Amazon is making a big expansion on Chicago's southwest side. The company bought the 70-acre Central Steel and Wire plant last month for $35 million, and it's one of Amazon's biggest land deals in the Chicago area. The site at 3000 West 51st Street will be a delivery station that'll launch in the next few years. Construction is slated to start in 2023. This new location brings Amazon's Illinois holdings to 17 fulfillment and distribution centers, 28 Whole Foods stores, and 7 Amazon Go stores. Zoning has been approved for a proposed film studio in the South Shore neighborhood. The Chicago Plan Commission gave the go-ahead to the $60 million project that could anchor a new entertainment district on the southeast side. The studio is the idea of Southside native Derek Dudley, the producer of the Showtime series, The Chi. The city council still has to approve the studio, which would take over the site of a former Kmart store along the Chicago Skyway. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Agribusiness headlines, Steve Alexander.
Yeah, journey back with me, John, to my childhood for a moment, if you would, please.
Yeah, okay.
And one of the best moments this time of year was when the tomatoes were ripe and ready, and I'd grab a salt shaker and go outside and find a shady spot in the tomato patch, sit and eat them right off the vine.
I'm learning a lot about you, Steve, here.
Mm. Yeah, OMG. Well, it's Mr. Fizz Friday, and our gardening guru, Jim Fizzell, says tomatoes and a lot more that you've been working hard to grow ought to be ready to pick, and the time of day you pick is important.
Steve, you need to pick in the morning when things are cool and fresh. Let the dew get off. As soon as the dew is gone, go out and do your picking. The produce will be nice and cool. Now, with the vegetables, you need to time your harvest for the best quality and freshness. When things like tomatoes are fully ripe and red, peppers are either full size and green if you want them for green peppers, or they're fully colored up. Things like acorn squash, they do color up on the underside. The top will be green, and the bottom of that squash where it lies on the ground will be yellow. And herbs, if you're growing herbs for fresh use or for drying, those need to be young and tender and not yet flowering. Zucchini, I see these people bring baseball bats, and that's not the best zucchini. Zucchini is usually 6 to 8 inches long. When you let them grow big, they don't make any more zucchini. And, of course, if you're growing sweet corn, you need to get out there and test it a little bit to find out when it's just perfect.
And if you're picking fresh-cut flowers, Mr. Fizz has a tip. Put them in 100-degree water. And if you don't have some of that pre-made floral preservative, you can make your own.
50% water, 50% 7-Up.
Yeah, make sure it's the regular kind, he says, the kind with sugar, not the diet. The diet stuff does not work. At the Chicago Board of Trade, one of the many weather services that traders rely on for direction, came out today with a forecast suggesting lower-than-expected yields are not on the table anymore unless August goes hot and dry. So corn went from double digits higher to into the red. Beans, corn right now, I should say, is down about a half a penny. Beans are still pushing higher, about 15 cents, and wheat is up 21 cents. From the farm to your belly, just as the local sweet corn is starting to show up, today is National Corn Fritters Day. And oh, what a weekend's coming up. National Peach Ice Cream Day tomorrow. Sunday is National Ice Cream Day for all flavors. So have a good one. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
John Hansen here on the Wintrust Business Lunch till the top of the hour, right before Anna DeVlantis. And we've got information about what's happening in Chicago's Loop. The president and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance, Michael Edwards, joins us to chat over the June report. And Michael, I guess the arrow's pointing up, right?
Yes, finally. They all seem to be pointing in the right direction. Yes.
Let's talk about people in the buildings themselves. What have you guys found about that?
Well, we've changed a little bit the way we analyze that, and we're using a number that's really based upon Chicagoland because it's a national number, and there's a national group that measures these things across the country. And Chicago is performing better than other markets, performing worse than some. But we're at about 31% human occupancy in these buildings, and that's Chicagoland. And I think in the Loop, it's somewhat less than that. So I'm going to say it's between like 26 and 28%, a little bit less.
Which blows my mind because the traffic makes it feel like 100% of the people are back. Obviously, people may be using the CTA and the Metro a little bit less. So let's actually talk about that. What is happening on the CTA?
Well, the CTA is actually, I was on it yesterday, and I was surprised how many people were on it. People are actually sitting next to each other, which hasn't happened in quite a while, but I felt perfectly safe.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very respectful of wearing masks, you know, inside the train cars, which is, you know, great. Metro's added some lines, things seem to be rebounding, and we're very happy about that.
Yeah, it looks like 45% of normal, which sounds, again, low, but when you compare it to where we were before and where we were a year ago, that certainly is makes sense, right in the middle
Absolutely.
Of the two. One thing in this study I like is this pedestrian data. Before you tell us what it is, how do you conduct that? Do you have people at different intersections with like the little clickers that where you have people going into and out of the bar? How does that go?
Well, that's how we used to do it. But right now we have counters up on the parapets of a number of the intersections up and down State Street. We have 18 counters up there. And so they're counting what they call the human form as it walks up and down the street. And so we're at about 58% of our normal levels, which we say is 2019, which is way better than the 25% we were at, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic. So we're happy about that. And those are June numbers, but we believe that this last week we went over 1 million people on State Street for the week. Typically at this time, it's 2 million people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're around 60%.
Does that include the weekend where you have State Street with the performances? Is everyone out there when it's closed?
Right. So here's my commercial. This weekend it's going to be sunny, everybody. So Sunday's on State. It's going to be great weather. People can register at loopchicago.com to win a $1,000 staycation. But yes, the whole idea of that is to bring more people down. Our goal is to get 25% more pedestrians on State Street compared to a typical Sunday in July from 2019. So we've just begun to count that, and you know, a couple more weeks we'll have a better feel for what kind of activity we're generating.
I've noticed this a little bit too when it comes to parking. Boy, the one thing about the pandemic, you could get some deals, whether it's a digital app or just from the parking place itself. Still seems to be on the cheaper end, but those are creeping up a little bit.
Yeah, I've started to drive a little bit, mostly because the Sunday's on State. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, I had to go up to level 4. Now I got to go up to level 6. So there, it seems to be, and this is a total anecdotal,
right,
but it does seem to be busier. People are driving their car. And the apps where visitors can use automobiles, they're running at 2019 levels. So that's terrific.
What about hotels?
Hotels have reported their best week last week. They're at about 45%. We have some hotels here in the Loop that were at capacity. The Palmer House was almost at 800 rooms a week or so ago. So things are happening. They're coming back. We still have a long way to go, but we appreciate everybody coming down and enjoying downtown again. I think once those theaters begin to open, and Zuzani's has opened in the Loop, but as the other ones open in September and into October, I think, you know, it'll start to feel a little bit more normal.
You mentioned, I guess I'll say the cautious optimism. You mentioned people wearing masks on the CTA. Boy, if there's any reminder of how important it is to remember that there still is a pandemic happening, it's what's happening in LA County with the mask mandates going into place there. We certainly don't want to become that. Still got to be at least somewhat careful following the rules and regulations, especially on the CTA and other crowded spots.
Absolutely. Well, I was on a Zoom call yesterday with our colleagues in Ireland and in Wales, and they just went on another lockdown because of the virus. We don't want that to happen. So I wear my mask all the time, not because I have to, but I just want to keep reminding people that we're not through this yet.
Yeah, for sure. Michael Edwards, President and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance. You can find out more information at loopchicago.com. Thanks for joining us, my friend.
Thank you.